So this topic of a Jew surrounded by secular culture is something that is extremely relevant. It's something where we consciously and subconsciously are extremely influenced by what's around us. We do not live in the shtetl anymore, and we are constantly bombarded by the culture and by the culture around us and by people living amongst non-Jews, working with them, and having many, many interactions with them. Two of the questions that we're going to be dealing with is what is permissible and what is forbidden within our interactions with non-Jews? And secondly, how should their culture and society impact us? Meaning, of course, it does impact us, but we have the ability to filter certain things. We have the ability to live in certain communities where we shun the outside influences from us, and we have the ability, of course, to live in very, very open communities where we are extremely surrounded by them and by their culture. So I want to start with Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb's seminal work called Torah Umada. Now, the term Torah Umada was coined by him. Torah Umada means Torah with secular subjects, secular studies. And in his book, he writes the tension that he feels, the tension that he felt within what to incorporate within secular studies and what not to incorporate. And he says as follows, "This book is primarily, but not exclusively, intended for readers who are as troubled as is the writer by the vexing problems thrown up by the confrontation of Judaism and the Jewish tradition on one side, and, on the other hand, modernity and the secular civilization in which we live, specifically by the teachings of Torah, the eternal resource of divine wisdom and guidance, as it collides with the ever-changing wisdom of the secular culture of our scientific, technological, cosmopolitan society." So he says there's a tension there between the Torah and the Torah's view and the Torah's knowledge versus other wisdoms that we have. He says in the Western world, there are tremendous wisdoms, they're changing wisdoms, meaning certainly medicine is practiced differently. Science is different than what it was. But how much do we want to be involved and how much do we not want to be involved? Now, aside from, of course, the secular holiday tomorrow, it's also very apropos that the shiur is given this week. Because one of the things about Parshat Shavuot is this is the beginning of course, the redemption of the Geula from Yitzhiyah Mitzrayim. And the Midrashim that discuss what was it about the Jewish people that they deserve to be redeemed. And it happens to be there's three things that people refer to the most, which happens to be, I saw, is actually a combination of two separate midrashim. The three things that people refer to are, it's Lo Shanu Shemam, they didn't change their names, so they had Jewish names. They didn't change Lashonam, the way they spoke, and Umalbusham, and they didn't change their clothing. So if you imagine, just within those three things, imagine someone who looks like a Jew, who has a Jewish name, and a person who speaks Hebrew rather than the Egyptian language, then that is very distinctive. You're really not mixing in with the Egyptian culture that much. Now, of course, we know that they actually were pretty involved with the Egyptian culture. Avodah Zarah was rampant amongst the Jewish people. But certainly, this was their zchut. And we'll see the two different midrashim that are combined to form this. If you look in source 2, so it says, Rav Huna Mar B'Shem Bar Kapara B'Shvil Arba Dvarim Negal Yisrael Mitzrayim. So this midrash says there are four things that the Jewish people were redeemed for. Shelo Shinu Et Shemam, they didn't change their names, Ve'et Lashonam, their language, Ve'lo Amru Lashon Hara, they didn't speak Lashon Hara, Ve'lo Nimtza B'Neim Echad Mehen Parat Be'erba. And there wasn't anyone who was the base in immoral activities. And that's why they were redeemed. But if you turn to the next page, source 3, in Psikta Zucha, so it says, Davar Acher, Vayhi Sham Legoy. So it says, Melamej HaYisrael Mitzuyonim Sham, that the Jewish people were distinct. Shahaya Mabusham, their clothing was distinct. Umachalam, their foods were distinct, right? Gefilte fish. Not so many non-Jews have that. Ulashonam, and their language, their speech. Mishunam min ha-mitzrim. This is what set them aside from the non-Jews. So I saw an article that discussed this. How come people refer to just those three that I mentioned before, and people assume that just one midrash? So it became popularized by the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer writes that there's a pasuk that talks about Yaakov going to Shechem, and says he was Shalim when he got there. And he says Shalim is Rashi Teva, is an acronym for Shem, the name, Lashon, the language, and Malbush, and their attire, their clothing. And the Chasam Sofer spoke about this, and this was something that probably one of the biggest issues, not the biggest issue in his lifetime, because of the Enlightenment and what was going on around him. He was concerned, and he saw Jews being impacted by secular society and going off the Derech. And he said, look what we have to do. Look, we have to remain different from them. We have to be distinct, and we can't necessarily learn the things they're learning. We can't dress the way they're dressing, and we can't speak the way they speak. And certainly, let's say when it comes to people in certain communities that still hold on to speaking Yiddish exclusively. People I've had, could be you've had this experience as well, where you go up to someone and you start speaking English and they can't speak English. And this is America. And there is something certainly nice about that, of trying to be authentic to the way they grew up, the way their grandparents grew up. But of course, it's certainly a different hashkafa. And this whole topic is something that has tremendous halachic views and halachic differences, distinctions, as well as hashkafic, even more so. It might not be necessarily certain halachic things of how to live our life, but the transmitted hashkafa, let's say within how do we view sports. And is a person supposed to root for a team? Is a person supposed to go to these games? And is a person supposed to have posters of players on their wall? What are we supposed to do about that? And all this started with the biggest fear amongst the Jewish community throughout our existence, which is the fear of intermarriage. Obviously, the reason why it's the biggest concern is because if someone marries a non-Jewish woman, then their child is no longer Jewish, and that's it. We've had a chain for 3,000 years, and all of a sudden a person could end it just like that. And so the Chachamim were so concerned about the fear of intermarriage that they put up safeguards to make sure that people stay within the framework of halacha and stay within the framework of making sure that they themselves maintain the Jewish continuity for their children. This is based on a pasuk in the Torah where it discusses specifically that you can't intermarry. It says, "Lo titchatein bam, you shall not intermarry with them. Bitcha lo titein livno, you can't take a daughter for your son. Vitoli tikach levanecha, and you can't take a son for the daughter." Right? So it's explicit in the Torah. Why? Ki asirat bencha me'acharai ve'avdu Elohim acharim, chara af Hashem ba'achem v'ishmidcha maher. He says now, the pasuk discusses, and Rashi points this out, that even if, and I remember every time this topic comes up in school, so someone says, if it's a girls' class, so the girls say, but if I marry a non-Jewish boy, then our children will be Jewish. So the Torah says what will happen. It says it's true, but then that person will sway your child away from Judaism. And I can't imagine that the generations, after two generations, really continue to have Jewish offspring. Just from that, imagine a person looking at their role models, which are their parents, and seeing that mom intermarried. So, I mean, how could she hold me against intermarrying? What could she do to me? So,
and on top of that, I mean, if I can throw it out there, I mean, that also physically diluting the relationship of you know, the kids to Judaism. I think it also takes away, I don't know if the word is a stigma, I feel like there's a more positive word for that, but I think it takes away this positive version of a stigma that we have, where, hey, we, in order to continue our legacy and our people, it's important, dafka, not to intermarry, and not just, you know, it's okay as long as it's the mother, but, like, we have to hold strong to our roots.
Correct.
And that is gone.
Correct. Now, of course, obviously, there's a lot of halachic problems, even though, of course, the kids would be Jewish in that case, of every time you sleep together, you're actually not halachically married, and that is an avera, along with, let's say, we'll see some other things soon. But of course, there are a lot of problems in and of itself, aside from this one isser that a person would be violating. Now, if you go to source 9, so So this is the beginning of the discussion related to the Chachamim wanting to prevent that from happening. Right? We know that when it comes to let's say the laws of Shabbos, probably the most primary example, where the Chachamim made tremendous safeguards. They don't want us to violate something that the Torah says, so, you know, we are going to extend those parameters. Whenever it comes to people being frustrated with the extension of certain parameters, let's say, for example, the reason you can't ride a horse on Shabbos is because you might come to pull off a branch and then hit the horse to make him go faster with that branch. And pulling off the branch is, of course, nevirah. So that's why I can't ride a horse. So people might think, oh my God, like, just go in the field. Like, why do you have to go by the trees? And so I'd like to give the following mashal. When it comes to the subway system, I hope, and certainly I know for the New York subway system, that there's always probably about 2 feet, 3 feet of yellow paint right before the track, right at the edge. Because they know that a person shouldn't stand at the edge of the platform. A person should make sure to stand 3 feet back, 4 feet back, 5 feet back. Because what might happen, chas v'shalom, a train is coming, and a person just accidentally slips, and they fall in. So why would anyone, their right mind, take that chance? Even though it's a 1 in 1,000 chance that might happen, why would anyone risk that? Stand back. So the Chachamim over here knew that there's a real danger in violating Shabbos, in violating everything they're trying to protect. We want to extend this parameter to make sure you don't even come close to it. And within that framework, we'll see what they forbade in order to prevent this stuff from happening. So the Gemara says in Source 9, Itmar v'nei ma asru shekar shal ovdei Chachamim. Ra'an bar chama amar Rabbi Yitzchak mishum chatnus. That the reason why beer, having beer from non-Jews, let's say having wine that they make, this is forbidden because potential intermarriage. And in a future source coming up, when it comes to, if you go to actually source 12, I'll skip there for a second. So it discusses the laws about someone making bread. A non-Jew making bread, inviting you over for a meal. So Asur Chachamim Lechol Pat Shel Amamim, says the Shulchan Aruch, is forbidden for someone to have bread made by a non-Jew, Ovdei Chachamim Mishum Chatanah, because of the fear of intermarriage. So you see that drinks are forbidden, we see that bread is forbidden, and part of it was a very social thing. When did people get together? If you want to make a business deal, so let's assume there wasn't golf back then in the times of the Gemara, right? So you go to a restaurant, you go to a bar, you get together with someone, you talk with someone, and it's a very pleasant social interaction.
It's called breaking bread.
It is called breaking bread.
No, correct. That's really where that comes from, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah, correct. And also, certainly the concept of restaurants, which is a very new, relatively new concept, that back then they could have people who are coming over for a meal, and let's invite the neighbor. But the Chachamim said, we don't want Jews to mingle with non-Jews because that could lead to intermarriage. So you can't eat by them. You can't eat the food they made. You can't have the wine that they made. We want you to stay distinct. And we could, there of course, and we're not going to be delving into the questions of necessarily of this certain cases of like holiday parties of what if you have a drink there? What if it's non-alcoholic? Those are important questions. But at a base level, of course, they wanted to minimize our interactions. And if you look at Source 10, so Rashi discusses, when it says here, Mishum Chatanah, because of intermarry, it says, Shelo yargil laso mishto etzel oved kochavim v'itenin avivito. You shouldn't be accustomed to being at non-Jewish parties. And what's going to happen? You're going to look at the daughter of this person. You're going to look at some girl. The girl's going to look at some guy. And you know what? They're going to be interested. And it really like could become certainly a very, very big issue. I happen to know someone, a Jewish girl, who told me that she actually slept with a non-Jew. And she told me that they met at a bar, and then that led to them sleeping together. And I certainly was there to try to help this girl through it, emotionally, mostly.
A girl in high school?
Not in high school, no. No. A girl was post-college. But there's not a former student. But I, of course, wanted to help this person because it was, they're very it was a very emotionally difficult situation for them, of course. And just when they had that realization, when they had that regret, that harata for what they did. But I did at some point tell them that this halacha, because most people would think, you know what, like, who cares if I, like, have a beer with this non-Jew? What's going to happen? And this person said, it's crazy, like, it's so true that this could actually happen. Now, of course, sleeping with someone when you just meet them at the bar is not necessarily marriage, but that certainly could lead to marriage. That certainly could lead to a real relationship. And the more someone's in a relationship, the more one will rationalize something, and the more one will be pulled in that direction. Rabbi Sachs discusses in A Letter in the Scroll in Source 13, he discusses how over the generations, just a few generations ago, where Jewish people stopped adhering to these laws, and they didn't want to be different from the non-Jews, and they wanted to be intermingled, and they were almost embarrassed by their religious practices. And he writes as follows. He says, in many cases, our parents and grandparents were not absolutely sure that they wanted their children to be Jews. They didn't want them to marry out, but they also didn't want them to stand out, to be conspicuous. They wanted them to be secular Muranos, outwardly like everyone else, inwardly and privately Jews. Right? So they wanted them, some parents sometimes want their kids, like, don't walk around with your payas flopping in the air. Like, you should look like everyone else. You shouldn't act so differently. He says they wanted them to be visible as human beings, but invincible as Jews. They were haunted by the specter of anti-Semitism, and they were not wrong to be. But it left them deeply conflicted. They were Jews, but they were dedicated to proving that Jews are no different from anyone else. And we, whether we know it or not, have inherited that deeply conflicted world. Right? So when generations of people are scared to act as Jews, and they almost want to now embrace the secular society, so it really caused a tremendous catastrophe for the generation. And there was a tremendous research done in the Pew Research Center about, in 2013, related to intermarriage, and related to other things as well, but certainly related to intermarriage. And it says, the survey suggests that intermarriage is common among Jews. 44% of all currently married Jewish respondents and 58% of those who have married since 2005 indicate that they're married to a non-Jewish spouse. The survey also shows that in some important respects, U.S. Jews have a distinctive demographic profile. They're older than the U.S. population as a whole, have high levels of educational attainment, as well as an average household income, and are geographically concentrated in the Northeast. And I have the chart here for you to look at later to see how over the decades, intermarriage has become worse and worse. Now, aside from things that the Chachamim forbade us to do with non-Jews because of the fear of intermarriage, there are other concerns as well. One of the main concerns is Avodah Zarah. And when it comes to this, so there's a Mishnah that speaks about, and this is relevant to nowadays, it says literally nowadays, "Lifnei idehen shel goyim shlosha yamim asu laseiv latid imahem," that during the 3 days prior to a non-Jewish holiday, you should really not do business with them. Lash ilam vish olmehen, to speak to them, to ask them, "Hey, how are you doing? Greetings, hello." Lahalvotam v'lalvot mehen leparan v'lipar mehen, to lend them to pay back your debts. They wanted to minimize these business interactions that we had with non-Jews around their holiday times. And part of the reason, of course, is just our interactions, but why around the holiday times? Because here they're in a certain mood, and maybe they would thank their God. They would thank their Avodah Zarah, and we would be causing them to do that. So they wanted to minimize these types of interactions. Now, I'm not going to get into it much, but there's a very much more detailed discussion the way I have here, but a very interesting discussion and halachic debate about what is Christianity considered. Now, certainly when it comes to,
like, it depends on the Ramban about whether it's monotheistic or not.
Right, so there's, of course, let's say when it comes to Muslims, for example, so they believe in one God, the same God as us, and everyone agrees that's not Avodah Zarah. Everyone agrees when someone bows down to a statue and they say this statue created the world, that is Avodah Zarah. When it comes to Christianity, though, so Christianity is, they believe in the Trinity. So, right, Father, Son, Holy Ghost. And one of the main sources of this, we'll just discuss now, is source 17, the Tosfot in Bechorot, where if you go to the bold, so it says as follows, Ode Perish Rabbi Natan. Rabbi Natan explains, he further says, Bizman hazeh nowadays, Kulan nishba'im bekedoshim, v'ein tofsim behem elohot. That when people swear to these holy people, these saints, so they don't believe that these saints are gods. V'afal pishimaz kirini mahem shem shamayim, and even though they might attribute the name of God to them, v'kavanatam l'davar acher. Their kavana, their intention is really for something else. Mikol makom, but nonetheless, ein ze shem avodat kochavim. This is not considered idolatry. Ki daitam l'shem osa shamayim va'aretz. Because when they think of God, they think of the same God that you and I think about. They believe that God created the heaven and the earth. The af agav shemishtatef shem shamayim v'davar acher ein kan lifnei iver lo titei mechshol. And even though they attribute something else, the word mishtatef, shituf, means a partnership. So even though they believe, let's say, in the Son of God, they believe there's some partnership there, he says there's still no prohibition of lifnei iver, of, let's say, making them swear in the name of their God. Now here's a very, very tricky thing. These words are words which have tremendous debate over them. Because it says non-Jews are not prohibited al kach, on this. He doesn't define kach. He does not define what this is. And so there's two different explanations of what does this mean. The first explanation is that he says that a non-Jew can be a Christian. There's no problem for a non-Jew to be a Christian. Now this is not from Rabbeinu Tam, this is the understanding of what Rabbeinu Tam is saying. That because Christians, they believe the same God that we believe in, they just believe that there's a partnership amongst God. He's not the only power, but he is a power. And the Ramah happens to, it seems, certainly has that notion. If you look in the next verse, we'll get back to the second way of reading this in a second. So Hagaz, the Ramah says, V'yesh makilin be'asiyat shutfut im ha'akum. This is related to having a business partner who's a non-Jew. So he says, there are those who are lenient having a business partner with non-Jews, bizman hazeh, nowadays, mishum she'en ha'akum bizman hazeh nishba'im be'avodat elilim. Because nowadays, the non-Jews, they're not swearing to these false gods. The afagav, the mazkirin havodah zara, and even if they mention this avodah zara, mikol makom kavanatam lo'oseh shamayim v'aretz. What is their intention when they swear in the name of God? It's not a god of avodah zara. It's the same God that we believe in. El shem etatfim shem shamayim v'davar acher. Rather, it's God with some other deity. The lo matzino sheyesh v'azeh mishum lifnei iver lo titei mechshol. There are inamus harm alashitov, and this is not considered lifnei iver to make them swear in this way, because there's no prohibition of shitov, of them believing in a god and something else. Now, many argue on this Ramah. Many say that the Ramah is wrong. And the other way to interpret the last line of the previous Tosfot is as follows. When he says, D'bnei Noach lo suhar al kach, B'nei Noach are not, non-Jews are not forbidden for this. What is this? Is that a non-Jew could swear in the name of their deity. That there's no prohibition for a non-Jew to swear in the name of their God, not being Hashem. Why? Because what's problematic for them? Is to serve avodah zarah. Swearing in the name of avodah zarah is not a problem. Serving the avodah zarah is a problem. We know for us, right? We are not allowed to swear in the name of another God. But for them, they could do that. And that's what some say this whole Tosfot is talking about. That there is a huge problem with them serving and being Christians. And that's just important to be, because a lot of halachic applications of doing business dealings with them and giving gifts to them stem from that that issue at hand. And if you go to the next source, on source 19, on page 7, so it says, Asur, the Shulchan Aruch says, Asur l'shaloach doron lo'ovei kachavim b'yom chagam. It is forbidden to give a present to a non-Jew on the day of their holiday. Unless you know for sure they're not going to be serving, they don't serve another god. And happens to be whether Christianity is or is not considered avodah zarah, there are certain leniencies related to the fact that if you're doing, let's say for example, people give a tip to the garbage man, to their landlord. Now, part of the reason for that, I'd say one of the main reasons, is not because we want to recognize them and thank their God and give them something around this time. It's because we don't want the garbage man to drag our garbage along the floor. We don't want our landlord to cut off our heat. Some people do that. People have houses. I know my father does it every year. People who give a nice gift to the cleaning lady. So it's for these reasons. It's not because you necessarily want to recognize their God and do something so nice for them, but it's because you don't want them necessarily to treat you like garbage and look down upon you. When it comes to business partners, so it's the same type of thing, where this is proper etiquette, and if you don't do this, then you're actually going to be in pretty big trouble. And so that's one important thing. Now, when it comes to acting like non-Jews also. So source 20, the Torah tells us, Kamasa Eretz Mitzrayim Asher Yishavtem Ba, Lo Tasu. Remember Egypt where you were? So don't act like the Egyptians. Kamasa Eretz Kanan Asher Ani Meviyatchem Shama, Lo Tasu. And when I'm going to bring you to Eretz Kanan, to the land of Israel, don't do like the people who live there. B'chukotehem Lo Telichu. And don't follow in the ways of their laws. And the Rambam, the Mor Nevuchim, he explains this as follows, and this is something that's actually really relevant also to somewhat limit and for a way for us to think about incorporating non-Jewish practices into our daily life and daily routine. He says, "L'harchik, a person should distance themselves mikol ma'aseh hakishuf, hashir me'asot davar mitzvoteihem, that a person should stay away from any type of witchcraft." And even related to things that deal with agriculture and deal with herding cattle. Lomar He says why? Because if they're doing something and it seems totally illogical, then you can't do it because you have to be concerned that they're doing it because they believe in certain superstition or certain witchcraft. He says, Aval, noheg lefi datam kiminhag hasegulot ve'akocho amilchadot. He says, because you have to understand that they are doing this with a kavana, specific intention of a certain segulot, certain superstition, v'humral v'hu amru v'lo teilecha v'hu kodagoy. And therefore, that's why the Torah says you should not fall in their ways, because their ways are extremely superstitious. They're based on things that are not based of Torah, and there are a lot of concerns that come up anytime you see something that seems irrational, that doesn't have any real reason. If you go to source 22, so if you look in the bold, so in the Ramah, in Yordaya, he says something very, very important, and this, a lot of certain things that we do, let's say that sometimes the way we dress, sometimes the way we act, is based on this. O bedavar shenahagu leminhag lechok be'ein tam bedavar deika lemechash be mishum darchei hamori v'sheish bo shemetz avodah kochavim me'avotem. That you should be concerned in terms of acting like them for when they do something irrational, because you don't know why they're doing it. It might be superstitious. It might have a shemetz avodah kochavim. There might be something there that actually has a basis in avodah zarah. Aval, he says, davar shenagu lito elet, something that has a purpose. He says, kigon, shedarkan shekol mi shehu rofe mumche, that it's the practice. When you have a doctor, has a doctor dress? A doctor wears a white coat. Yesh lo malbush miyuchad shenikarbo. They wear a specific distinct outfit that makes them recognizable. Shehu rofe uman, that people know there's a doctor. Mutar lelosho, it's permitted, or it's permissible for a Jew to dress that way, for a Jewish doctor to dress like that. V'chein she'osem mishum kavod otam acher mutar. He says, or if this dress is to show that someone is distinct and distinguished, or for some other reason, but it's irrational, then it's permissible. He says, let's say, for example, let's say it wouldn't be where a doctor is doing that, and obviously it's like he'll know who's a doctor and not a doctor. If you just see someone wearing a white coat, and that's the way people are dressing, he says, you might have to potentially be concerned that they're doing this for a avodah zara, that there was maybe some superstitious act, there might be something that traces back. There's discussions related to haircuts, and specifically, let's say, the way the monks got haircuts, where this was something that they did for avodah zara, and there's certain prohibitions about how to even cut her hair. Now, thank God the monk haircut is not in nowadays.
I don't even know what it is.
I think it's like if you put like
the bowl cut around it.
Yeah. So thank God it's not so in.
It's making a comeback.
Yeah, that's right.
What about like rally caps and baseball or all the superstitions for sports?
Good question. Good question.
What are rally caps?
When you flip the fat upside down, because
your team is down at the bottom of the ninth, then you flip it.
It's super.
So not certainly not giving up stock, and I certainly do not know. I've listened to Shiram on this, but one thing I'll say is that if a person, let's say, knows 100% that what they're doing has zero validity, then you could probably do it. But if there's a small reason of, you know, there might be something to it, then that becomes problematic. There was a student of mine last year who was a very diehard Yankee fan, and
we failed him.
And and this kid, he drew the Yankee symbol on his arm, and apparently every time he did that, they won. And he asked me, I can't remember if he asked me or found out he was doing it. I have a very good relationship with him. And there happen to be two issues with it. Firstly, there's an issue of getting something that someone might think is a tattoo. We know we're not allowed to get tattoos, but getting a fake tattoo that looks real, where someone might think it's real, is a problem. If everyone knows that it's fake, that's okay. So that could be one issue. But another issue is, it's totally superstitious. This symbol on my arm is going to determine whether they win or not. Now, I said to him, I told him, I said, tell me the next time you do it, and I'm going to dominate the Yankees lose. But I also said to him, I said, just practically, I mean, realistically, the Yankees aren't going to win every game. And you're going to do this till they lose, but then when they lose, you're going to realize, wow, that actually didn't work. And I told him this idea. We spoke about the concept of superstition, and there is certainly, within Judaism, there is something called a segula, but a segula is something that is based in something. Superstition is based in nothing. And so these types of things do happen, but if a person knows that what they're doing has absolutely no merit, then that could potentially be permitted. The only reason to say maybe it's still not permitted is because people see you and they think that you buy into this. Right? A person walks into a non-kosher restaurant, so if it's totally unkosher, they probably know that you're just going to the bathroom. If it's unclear, right? Oh, like, I saw Reish Schlossberg going there, so it must be that it's kosher. Really, it's not kosher. Or, oh, you know what? Wow. I thought Reish Schlossberg was so from. Like, I guess he's not. Right? Those are two big problems that could come out of that. Now, when it comes to... Apologize for one second. We're going to skip to page 10. So when it comes to, let's say, just... This is more those types of issues. When it comes to, let's say, pop culture and the culture around us. So there was recently on Hanukkah, so YU puts out something called the Torah to Go. And their whole issue was about how the Jews interact with secular culture. And I felt like it would almost be cheating. I felt like it was almost immoral for me to base my entire shiur off of that. So I tried to base almost nothing off that. But there were certain things where I can't avoid. Like, it wouldn't do the Shir justice if I didn't say anything from that, where there's so many Talmidei Chachamim who are stating their opinions on very important matters that are extremely pertinent to this topic. So, Rabbi David Shefkin quotes of Aaron Lichtenstein, and where when it comes to culture, certainly, originally when it came to how Jews interact with secular culture, they're referring to let's say something called high culture, right? Let's say when it comes to art, or art and science and philosophy. So should a Jew read non-Jewish philosophers? It's an interesting question. So Rav Lichtenstein said, the children in centrist summer camp today do not waste away their summers because they're busy mastering Bach or Euclid. Right? That's not our issue. We don't see too many people walking around and reading Plato and Socrates. Not that that isn't done at all, but certainly the bigger issue is pop culture. And when it comes to an attitude towards sports, so I want to just discuss, I'll discuss both sides of it. The first is from Rav Daniel Feldman, who's asked this question in that same Why You Tour to Go, as well as the next source from Rabbi Benovitz and Rabbi Rothweck. So Rabbi Feldman said as follows, I should mention first, although he's going to say something that is not positive in the way we view sports, he does give this important caveat, and I felt it would be an injustice to him, because I know he's extremely humble, a really great person who always understands the other side. So I wanted to make sure to put this first part in, even though this is not the focus of why I brought this. He says, I should mention first that many wonderful B'nai Torah, many outstanding Talmidei Chachamim, who are far beyond me, have benefited greatly from their appreciation of sport, and have found a place for it in their spiritual lives that fits well with their overall character. That being said, I do think it is important to be aware of the risks that are attached to sports fandom. The admiration of professional athletes generally focuses on skills and abilities that do not have inherent moral or spiritual value, and then draws us into idolizing of individuals who may not have any other traits worthy of emulation by B'nai Torah. He says, if you think about sports, look what we are admiring. It's not about their midot. It's specifically about their skill and putting posters up of people just because of that. That's not something necessarily that a Ben Torah should try to emulate. Rav Benovitz and Rabbi Rothwax, in a separate article, this was not the same article, this article specifically was discussing sports and religious attention. They wrote as follows, sports provides a projection of certain positive values and a showcase arena for a true learning experience. The Gemara identifies an opportunity to learn traits like modesty and honesty from the behaviors of cats and ants. Apparently, there is an educational process that can emerge from less likely and obvious teachers. There are certain values that are conveyed through sport, and these can indeed be learning opportunities. Teamwork and social cohesion are prime examples. Focus, determination, and perseverance are others. They said, it's true that the people themselves, may or may not have great midos. And certainly, and I try myself to point out the ones that do. To point out how, let's say, Andrew Luck, quarterback for the Colts, he wishes congratulations, and the people who sack him, the defensive back, whenever he gets sacked, he says, nice hit, great job. And when it first started, people thought like he was playing a mind game on them, but he actually was just a genuinely nice person. Tim Duncan, who's extremely humble, who was a basketball player retired a few years ago for the Spurs, he's extremely humble, and there's some really great stories that people can learn from them. But the average athlete, it's not about their character, you can still learn a lot about the way they push themselves, and the way that, about their teamwork, and determination, and focus. A story about someone named Rabbi Chaim Eisenstein, who's a rabbi in the Kiva Aryeh, and was a tremendous hashpah and influence over many, many Jews. He gave a shiur 6 years ago by the last name of God about an incident that occurred 29 years ago. This thing happened, I'm only saying this because he said it publicly, and it has over 450 listeners on Why You Torah. And he said that when he was in high school, his yeshiva gave him a ticket to the Siyam HaShas. And he went to the Siyam HaShas with his friends, was standing outside Madison Square Garden, and they weren't really interested to go, though. And they're standing outside, and he said, like, let's see what we can make for this. And the ticket was $10, had $10 value. And here they were, Jewish kids, scalping their ticket to the CMHS. He said he sold his ticket for $100. $100, $10 ticket for $100. And he titled this, "My CMHS with Michael Jordan." Because afterwards, what did he do with it? So he went to Modell, the Sports Authority, or whatever he went to, and he bought a Michael Jordan t-shirt and other paraphernalia. And his parents were so saddened by what he did. And he said he learned a very important lesson, in hindsight, of course, about how we value things and what we put on a pedestal and what we don't. And it's important to think about that. Kushner has a Sinai program, which is in the same building, and sometimes even Sinai students are in Kushner, mainstream Kushner classes. And there's a person who's a Sinai student, a kid, his name is David. And David loves rabbis. And he loves reading biographies about rabbis. And whenever he meets someone, he takes a picture of them. He's so excited to meet them. And just today, a fellow rabbi came up to me and said that, "You want to hear what's happening today? I'm taking David to meet Reuven Feinstein, the son of Moshe Feinstein." So he said as follows. He says that David wrote a letter to him, like a heartfelt letter about a certain issue in his life. And this rabbi who grew up in, went to the yeshiva where Reuven teaches, yeshiva Staten Island, he said Reuven said he wants to meet this kid. And the school, the Sinai school, said, "We're going to send him." They sent him today, and he came in, and he was dressed like suit and tie, and he bought all his books over Moshe Feinstein to ask him to sign them. And I saw the picture after the ride came back. I saw a picture of him with Reuven Feinstein, and his face is beaming. And if you think about the average kid, though, the average kid in our high schools, and I don't blame the kids, like I said, it's the society we live in, but how excited would they have been to necessarily meet Reuven Feinstein? And if it was a choice of meeting Reuven Feinstein or LeBron James, who would they have met, whether it's Taylor Swift or Beyonce? And it's important for us to think about the people that we look up to, the people who are, if you think about literally like American Idol, like idol is not necessarily the most proper terminology, right? The people that you put on a pedestal. It's important, to, of course, to look at them. And as we saw from the article by Rabinowitz and Rothwax, that we should be in admiration for them, for what they can achieve and for the feats that they've excelled in, but to not necessarily put themselves on the pedestal and to not take it too far. Rabbi Lam, I'm going back to his book, Torah Mado, where he discusses the trying to weave the two. And when it comes to bringing Jewish values with secular knowledge and weaving them together of what that leaves us. It says it's true, and I'll read it in a second. It's true, there's potential danger involved, but he says he thinks it could be a beautiful masterpiece when it comes together. He says as follows, "Religiously committed individuals who participate in our contemporary society and culture are beset by a conflict of values and perceptions that is of the greatest personal consequence. The encounter of the two worlds within religious individuals and communities often leaves deep scars on the psyche of the individuals and the ethos of the community. But it also holds the promise of fascinating creativity, of new syntheses, of renewed efforts to grasp elusive insights." He says, if you go to the end of it, go to four lines from the bottom of this source on top of the next page, the two worlds, I'm in the middle of that line. "The two worlds of faith and inquiry, of religion and science, of trust and reason, are destined, not doomed, to live together, now close and now far, now attracting and now repelling, like twin stars revolving about each other in some distant corner of the galaxy." He says, we could work in a perfect synthesis together, and we're able to incorporate the things that actually make us better, right, as Jewish people, and learning and there's a line, "Chachma begoyim tamim," they have tremendous knowledge, and we can learn from them. And the last thing I want to just focus on, the last two sources, are about how we engage non-Jews and how we treat them. It's not just necessarily of what dangers we should have and how they are going to affect us, but how should we view them? And the Hamik Davar in his introduction to Sefer Bereishis, he discusses how the name of Bereishis is called Sefer HaYashar, Sefer HaYashar, the Book of the Just. And he says this is based on Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov themselves being called Yesharim. And if you look at the second set of bold, where it says Vizeh, he says, Vizeh haya sheva ha'avot. This is the praise of the avot. Shemelvah shehayu tzadikim v'chasidim v'o'av Hashem. Despite the fact they're tremendously righteous and pious and lovers of God, v'ofen hayo tershar, in the greatest possible way, od hayu yesharim haynu she'etnagu im umot ha'olam. Look at the way of how just they are in their interactions with the non-Jews. Afilu ovdeilin mechuar, even the people who are the most despised non-Jews, who are the most despised idolaters. Mikol makom hayu imam ba'ava, they are with them in love. V'chashu l'tovatam ba'asher hikiyom habriya. Kimo, and he gives an example. She'anu roim kama ishtateach Avram avinu t'pal al Sodom. Look at just for example, Avram davening for Sodom. If you were to hear as an amazing, let's say, pious religious person, you hear about a city that God wants to destroy, and the city is filled with like rapists and thieves and murderers. You'd throw a party; it would be a big simcha. Avram says, "No, these are human beings. How could you destroy them?" And Avram is the person who defends and who he himself, of course, interacts with them, tent open on all four sides, wants to bring them closer, wants to help them, wants to act properly towards them and with them. And that is why it's called Sefer Yashar. That's why they are called Yasharim, for the way they interact with others. And the last source Rabbi Sachs discusses in The Dignity of Difference, where he says, if you think about Jewish people, we have been the people who are the other. We are people who are minority. And certainly throughout our generations, we have been beaten down, both physically and emotionally. And he says as follows, nowhere in the singularity of biblical ethics more evident than in its treatment of the issue that has proved to be the most difficult in the history of human interaction, namely, the problem of the stranger, the one who is not like us. Most societies at most times have been suspicious of and aggressive towards strangers. That is understandable, even natural. Strangers are non-kin, right? They're not related to us. And look, of course, the way they're going to be treated. They come from beyond the tribe. They stand outside the network of reciprocity that creates and sustains communities. That is what makes the Mosaic books unusual in the history of moral thought. As the rabbis noted, the Hebrew Bible in one verse commands, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," but in no fewer than 36 places commands us to love the stranger. So, of course, we know, "V'ahavt lerecha kamocha," love another Jew, treat them like yourself, when it says to love the stranger, Hatem Tagir, no fewer than 36 times, how much we're supposed to think about the other, how cautious we're supposed to think about loving every person we come in contact with. And of course, it's important to realize how we are identifiable as Jews. You might be able to, as a guy, put on a cap. Owen might be able to dress a certain way. And, you know, people might not think you're Jewish, but they know you're Jewish. And of course, we want to, even though we try to dress distinctively and dress in a certain appropriate nature, knowing that we're always befriended with Hashem, people know we're Jewish. And it's an important thing for us to keep that in mind and to have our interactions with them to be Mamleches Kohanim L'Goy Kadosh, as the Torah says. That we're supposed to be the light to the nations, and all of our interactions in terms of what we're able to glean or what we don't want to take from them, the way we sit with them or don't sit with them at a party, the way we talk to them and interact with them, everything should be in the most proper way, within the mentality of being cautious on the one hand of things that might lead to problems, but also thinking about the positive contributions we should have and the kiddush Hashem we're able to make. So thanks so much for coming.
Yeah. Wow.